people don't understand you have to have a certain amount of physical stability to learn, and you have to have a certain amount of physical stability to negotiate the workplace.
Poverty impacts everyone. And you know, we really can't be complete in our exploration of the future of work without including a conversation on the impacts of poverty, the causes of it. So we have our next guest. Ruby Payne was born in Indiana, spent her youth in Ohio, has been a high school teacher, central office administrator, a consultant for two different regional service centers, and an elementary principal. She's the founder of the AHA Process, which is a company that informs schools and companies about poverty. Now, she's the author of way too many books to list, but I'll name the one that is on our shelf, A Framework for Understanding Poverty. Ruby's spoken to more than a million educators, has given more than 4,000 speeches and presentations all around the world. In that book I mentioned, A Framework for Understanding Poverty, sold more than 1.8 million copies. Along her journey, Ruby conducts over 200 seminars a year, training as many as 25,000 teachers and school administrators to work with children in poverty. This makes Ruby one of the biggest influences on teachers and their understanding of children from poverty in the U.S. And for all these reasons, this is why I'm excited about having Ruby on the podcast today. She studied poverty all over the world, focusing on America for a moment as a nation where nearly one in two jobs, according to the Brookings Institute, is said to be a low-wage job, paying an American a wage below the poverty line. For this reason, HR leaders, corporate leaders, nonprofit leaders, academicians, policymakers should all get up to speed on the impacts of poverty on the psyche of our workers when they show up to work every day. So let's get rolling. Let's bring it in.
Maybe, Ruby, the best way to start is, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey and AHA Process?
Sure. I started out as a K-12 educator, and probably germane to the conversation is that I actually grew up on a farm in Ohio as a Mennonite, okay, which is a religion somewhat like an Amish, okay, but more modern, both pacifist. And I did get kicked out. Okay. Long story there. All right. But I started out as a K-12 educator. And so I've always been fascinated by learning and how people know what they know and how they decide how to live. And as a result of that, I was in the K-12 business directly for 22 years. Six of those, I worked with regional service centers, which are the agencies between the State Department and the local districts. Okay. We did tons of training. I saw many, many different models of schooling and leadership. Then I started my own company with the book I wrote, A Framework for Understanding Poverty, and started my own company, which I've had for 25 years. How I got interested in poverty is that my former husband, who died in 2010, was a mix of Cherokee and Caucasian. He came out of extreme poverty, generational poverty, and situational, but his family was the smartest family I've ever met in my life. He has three siblings with IQs over 150. He has a sibling with an IQ of 160, photographic memory. Now, if you know anything about intelligence or how it's measured, when you get to 145, you're three standard deviations beyond the norm. You get to 160, you're four standard deviations from the norm. It becomes incredibly difficult to fit. And in this particular case, you have a lot of issues there. And interestingly enough, the three with the highest IQs never really developed their talent.
When you mentioned the education business, Ruby, How are schools doing right now?
I'm fascinated by cognition, how people know what they know and how they negotiate their realities, okay? And I've done work around the world. I lived in Haiti for 3.5 months and studied poverty and service. And one of the things is that the K-12 business got off, the train got off the track with Common Core for this reason. They forgot about conceptual learning and they went straight to skill-based learning. And the concept was we're going to break up learning into these discrete skills that we can measure, okay? So in that process then, they forgot about conceptual frames. And in the research on schema, the cognitive research, well, let's go back and look at the research on situated learning, okay? When you know that 95% of the brain is structured by the time you're six, okay? One of the things you understand that a lot of that structuring occurs in the reality you're in, and it's without formal education, and it's based upon the understandings of the people around you, okay? And what happens in that frame then, you learn how to negotiate a reality. So you have conceptual frames that you use called schema, and when we went to these discrete objectives, then people didn't have anywhere to put the information. Your brain groups in patterns. Your brain is a pattern-making mechanism and groups in patterns. And when you take away conceptual frames from kids, then it's kind of like it has no place to go.
Sure. I mean, it's interesting that the point you're bringing up, because I feel like today an area that you have a lot of expertise in, there's almost like a gap in how we learn how to learn. Is that fair to say?
Very much so. So right now, learning is actually, if you read the work of Lave and Winger, they looked at how people learn, okay? Situated learning, and they learn in situations, okay? And you're co-authored in your learning, okay? What happens if you look at Feuerstein's work, who did some of the best cognitive research early on that the computer industry borrowed very heavily from? Basically, Piaget, I'll just back up and give a little history. Piaget was the biologist who researched Pavlov's dog, you know, stimulus response, et cetera, okay? Feuerstein was this brilliant Israeli educator. And he said to Piaget, he studied under Piaget, you say that if a person has the right stimulus in the right amount of time, you'll get a response. He said, how do you account for individual differences? And Piaget said, I don't, because I'm a biologist. I care about accommodation and assimilation. I don't care about individual differences. Well, Feuerstein had also studied under Vygotsky, who was a Russian psychologist. And Vygotsky believed that learning was mediated, okay? And so what Feuerstein came out with this model that said basically a mediation model, which was this, okay? It's a what, why, how model at the very simplest. Here's the adult, you have a caring relationship that points out to you what you're supposed to pay attention to. Here's what you pay attention to, here's why, and here's how you do it. For example, we say to young children, don't cross that street without learning, without looking. Why? You could get killed. Strategies, look both ways twice. That's mediated learning, okay? Well, that requires a knowledge base and an information base. And that gets transmitted intergenerationally. University of Chicago did research and found that if you are in a high poverty neighborhood, two generations or more, your IQ drops by a half a standard deviation just because of the transfer of knowledge. So in a lot of talent development now, still to this day, people are doing a lot of work with job skills, job application, but they're not doing much with the conceptual frames you have to make sense.
Profess to, I guess, how do we get on the right track?
Oh yeah, I mean, it's not hard, okay, to get on the right track, but you don't start out with measuring discrete, like somebody, I don't know if you've looked at testing, but I just in December worked with a middle school in Ohio who is on the list of underperforming schools. And so we looked at state assessment items because most of them have never seen them and they're horrible. I mean, my son has a PhD in biophysics. I sent him a math one. He couldn't answer it.
Yeah.
I have a master's degree in literature. I couldn't answer some of the ones. So one, and these are seventh grade. These were middle school kids. So the bottom line, it is so specific and so discreet that if you don't have the conceptual frames for them, you can't even answer the questions because they assume a conceptual frame. So you asked how you begin to educate that. And one of the things you have to teach kids is pattern making, how to group, and you have to teach attributes. And a lot of that is in the cognitive research that was used in the 1970s in schools. And so what happened in the 1980s and what happened then, they got dropped out of the curriculum. Like, for example, they no longer teach multiplication in schools. Okay, because one of the reasons that's multiplication is basically a mathematical conceptual frame. Okay, and so it's been dropped.
Your message on the assessment resonates in Newark, New Jersey, where we are. We worked with the city who has adopted a standardized test that they use. And if you're an out of work worker, and these are predominantly folks who are poverty is a reality, they're vulnerable populations, they have a requirement for you to take this standardized federally approved test. And I think when we started working with them, there's like a 20% passage rate on this. And simply to gain access to any career counseling, and it just makes me it's mind blowing that, you know, that barrier, because in some ways these tests are being used as barriers to entry for certain people.
It's not some ways, it's across the board. And let me say this. What has happened is this: if you're in the school business, it's relevance, rigor. They have a model: relevance, rigor, relationships, if you want kids to learn. Okay. There's tons of rigor in the assessments. They have formulas for text complexity, but they have no standards for relevance. Okay. So the bottom line, I'll just give you this one example. I wrote an article about it. I was so angry. Okay. Because I felt like we are destroying kids before they ever get a chance to get started. Okay. But on language arts, for example, just talk about no relevance. Of all the sample test items I looked at for middle school kids, only one had a minority child in the story. And I could find no minority authors. And it was literature that was 300 years old. Okay. So there's no relevance there. By relevance, I mean there's no reference to lived experience. You have no criteria for it. Like one of the test questions that I objected to in Texas was this one for a third grader writing prompt. Right? Describe your closet in detail. All right. Now that assumes that you have a closet. That assumes that you aren't homeless. That assumes you're not living in your car. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I said, why didn't you write a prompt like this? Tell about a time in your life. Describe a time in your life when you were unhappy or happy. That's a universal experience. Why would you choose a lived experience that 20% of your kids don't have? So there's no relevance criteria. And the other, the problem with just an aside with state assessments, and one of the reasons they knocked so many people out, is there's no review process, except they'll say, well, we let a group of teachers look at them, but the teachers don't control whether those items ever get on the test or not. Okay. And no one gets to go back around behind and say, this was a bad item. So it's a very closed, secretive process. So there's no transparency. So you can't vet items that are really inappropriate. So they need criteria for relevancy.
As you're talking, you know, one of the things I think about is just the present news cycle. You know, over the last 5 days, it feels like there's a heck of a lot of news that is picking on workers, maybe is the softest way for me to say it. I had a flight the other day and I was in the airport, and I think all three newspapers on the newsstand had a front cover article talking about workers being characterized as lazy or taking advantage of unemployment benefits or staying at home. And I want to get your opinion on this, because I think that so many, you know, today there's one in two American jobs, or some economists would call bad jobs, paying folks below the poverty line to do work. There's a lot of different realities that impact folks that are living in poverty that have to go to work every day. What's your take, you know, kind of in this moment as we think about our workforce and poverty?
See, one of the issues is that if I were in poverty right now and I could make twice as much money at home on unemployment, believe me, I would not be going back to work. One of the issues in poverty is that employers think that there's not intelligence there. There's intelligence there, okay? But how it's presented is not considered appropriate. Let me give you an example. One of the things we know from the research is that in educated or stable households, which is what I call middle class, people speak what is called formal register. It's words that are in writing, okay? So it's necessary for a business community. It's necessary for the legal community. You have to put things in writing when somebody's not there, so there's some sort of agreement, okay? Word choice is quite specific. But among friends, what you talk is casual register. So casual register is what you see in texting. It's what you see in, okay, here's the problem. If I go into a job interview and I say, I ain't got none, or I do a media interview and I say, I ain't got none, the immediate assumption is that I'm not intelligent. Language is learned. And so what we find is that the ability to use the abstract language is in formal register. Well, what we know is that if you come out of a financial poverty household, you only have half the words. So what happens then when somebody explains themselves to media and they use the casual register, the immediate understanding is, well, they're just not very bright.
There's an argument to be made today that there really isn't a skills gap. There's a experience gap. There's also a gap in the hiring and selection process. There's a lot of bias in what HR roles may look for when they're trying to evaluate a new hire. Do you feel like, how do you think about skill gaps because of that? Because I mean, to your point, you might hear someone using the informal register and it might classify them as not being educated. And then you might turn around and say to your boss, I can't find someone to fill this role because, you know, I can't find the right skills.
Well, there is a skills gap. Okay. Because part of what that's true, okay? But part of what's misunderstood is there's not an intelligence gap. There is a skills gap, and there's a gap with learned negotiation of environments, okay? For example, and I'm an employer, okay? I've got 20 employees. I've done this for 25 years, okay? One of the things is when you start, we have a program called Workplace Stability in which we help employers stabilize the workplace for individuals whose external reality is unstable. Part of what happens is when your external reality is unstable, okay, then you're going to bring that instability into the workplace, all right? So what happens is that gets translated a lot is there's not the skills here. They can't plan, they can't get here on time, they can't do this, they can't do that. Well, really, the external reality is unstable, okay? And the understandings of how you negotiate. Let me give you just one example here quickly. I think this will clarify why people call it skills. But when you're in a stable environment like middle class, okay, your driving force, see, no matter where you are around the world, you're going to make time is the defining factor for people. They have 24 hours a day, period. How you take that time and your resource base, you put it on an axis and you manipulate it so that you can meet your needs, okay? Middle class driving force is three things: work, achievement, and material security. So what middle class does is they spend their time at work, okay? They go to school to get a better job, and they buy things that become an asset, like material security, a mortgage, right? Middle class has, I'm going to ground your question just indirectly, but you'll see it in a minute, okay? So that's your driving force. So work is really important. It's part of your stability package. In wealth, you have a different problem. Your problem is you have too many resources, and so you have to pay people to help you. And that makes you vulnerable at a personal safety level. They can rob you, they can kidnap you. So your deal about money and your time is that you're going to use your financial, your political, and your social connections because they keep you stable and safe. But in poverty, if you've been there two generations, then your problem is this. Your work is, for males, it's unpredictable. Unemployment is part of the picture, okay? The second thing that happens is what keeps you alive are relationships. So you make your decisions against survival, relationships, and entertainment, because that is what allows you to stabilize your environment and keep going. And what, and money is shared, it's communal. Okay. The problem is this: your relationships are more important to your stability than your work, because work is too unpredictable. So what you do to stabilize your environment is different than someone who in an educated household uses to stabilize their environment. So the way that translates in middle class is they don't have the skills.
Got it. It's super, I mean, it's super fascinating. I just, as you're talking, I just think that this is like a master class for any HR person that wakes up any day and he's trying to think about how do you connect with every worker in your workforce at all corners, not just, you know, one segment, which oftentimes that's, there might be only a few groups that get access to the, maybe the training to close or address certain skill gaps.
Well, for example, we have a guy in our warehouse. Okay. We've done a lot of activities to stabilize him. Okay. One of the things that happens in generational poverty is it's not unusual. There's legal issues, there's debt issues, there's all kinds of other issues that have to be stabilized because you miss too much work. So middle class says, I'm not going to spend, it's easy for employers to say, I'm not going to spend my money helping you stabilize your environment. Okay. Well, then the problem is you lose your money in retention and turnover. So we say to employers, hey, if you don't want to spend $6,000-$7,000 a person in turnover, which is what it costs you, then let's look at some tools that don't cost you nearly as much money to stabilize your workforce. And we've been able to say it's a much bigger picture than skills. It's your understanding of how the workplace works.
Has anything changed from your view since COVID? Like as COVID has made a direct impact on every part of work in our communities, is any, or you find yourself talking more on a specific topic today than you were a year ago?
Yes, we're not talking much about financial poverty now. We're talking about emotional poverty. One of the things that's really entering the workplace right now and is a significant issue in talent development is that the emotional stamina you have to develop expertise and the amount of stability you have to develop expertise is basically gone in generational poverty. People don't understand you have to have a certain amount of physical stability to learn, and you have to have a certain amount of physical stability to negotiate the workplace.
It makes perfect sense. I've never heard it said that way. And it makes, I mean, to have stability in order to be in a position to learn it. And yeah, it's super, super powerful. I have one closing question, Ruby. So much about what we're doing today is, when you turn on the news, you hear future of work this, future of work that, future work is all over the place. I think too often it's a conversation around robots, you know, showing up and taking everybody's work from them. So I'd like to ask you what your hope is for the future of work.
I would love it to be about the development of talent. I mean, there's so much undeveloped talent out there. I was in a school, they had a sixth grade kid, extreme poverty. He made a gasoline engine out of aluminum pop cans by himself. Come on, that's talent. And we have so narrowly defined talent. We've to the point where we've killed it. Right now, if you don't take 4 years of math in high school, you're out, okay? you can't go on to college. We've defined it so narrowly. And let me give you one example. We've gone to, in our schooling system, we've gone to strictly abstract representational knowledge bases. Okay. It would be like saying to adults, look, you can't have a driver's license until you take a class and pass a class in thermodynamics, okay? Okay, or let's just say physics, let's make it simpler. In physics, so you understand velocity and mass and speed, okay? And then we say, and you can't have driver's license until you pass a class in neurobiology, so you understand addiction and its impact on your ability to drive, okay? Think about how many people would never get a driver's license, okay? It's stupid, but we do that to kids. So everything, we knock talent out at every place. And then we wonder why we don't have any. I'm distraught, but I have preached till I'm done. You don't get talent the way we're doing it right now.
One recommendation, if you're a CEO out there listening, and one word of advice?
To the CEOs, I think Google right now has the best model. Here's what Google's model is. We don't care what your degrees are. Here are three problems. Can you solve them? And how would you solve them? What Google's doing right now with their certification that they're doing online, you don't have to have any degrees. You don't have anything. They make it so you basically don't have to pay for the course, all right? Do you have that? If I were a CEO right now and I were looking for talent, what I would do is I would start in middle school and I'd find out who these kids are. We're losing males by the droves, okay? Because males bond over activities, not over conversation. Male brains learn more if they have movement, okay? So one of the things is I would be looking at who are the outliers? Who are the kids that don't fit the norm, okay? There's talent there. It takes talent not to fit the norm, okay? And the thing of it is, I would look for those kids, and then I would put together some sort of, I'd buy computers, and I'd say, look, let me show you some basic things. I'd make it competitive. I'd say, can you do this? Let's play this game, da, 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 da. I would find the talent, but it's not being developed right now. For kids in poverty, very well at all K-12.
Yeah, we got a lot of work to do. I mean, I think we were just timely this past weekend. Our team joined a cleanup of the Passaic River here in Newark with the all men's rowing team at a local high school. That, how about this? They have to jog 4.5 miles. It's called St. Benedict's Prep. They have to jog 4.5 miles every day after school to get to the only slip to get into the water. It's an all black men's crew team. They have to jog 4.5 miles because there's not anything closer. And they're trying to, you know, focus inward on their community. And it was awesome to see local companies come out, be a part of that. Because what you just said, middle school, like, you know, I was just thinking high school, but you're right. I mean, we should be starting even younger.
I work all across the United States, work in the world, but right now, because of COVID, and this is something schools don't want to admit because of ADA, they cannot find or get in touch with 20% of their kids. I know this is a fact because I've talked to tons of educators. And here's the issue, middle and high school. The dropout numbers in the United States are incorrect for this reason. They use graduation rates, which you start with the freshman class in high school, and you look at how many of them graduated from high school, a four-year. But that's not when kids drop out. In poverty, the males in particular and the females drop out between the 8th and 9th grade. They just don't show up. And one of the things is, that's why I said middle school. That's where we lose them. In fact, one research project I was involved in, you could predict who would make it out of high school based on their 6th grade grades. So you want to look at that frame. There's unbelievable talent. It's just not developed. It's not disciplined. It's not channeled. So we're asking questions about 300-year-old poetry.
It doesn't make any sense. I mean, I put the TABE. It was called the TABE test, a federal test. Anybody out of work has to pass it to access career training, which is, by the way, crazy because we should just be giving career training to local folks who want to do it. We brought the practice test back to our office, and I had some of our team, they couldn't get to your point. It's stupid. I think you said stupid. I agree.
Well, we have a program called Getting Ahead in the Given by World that we've taken 90,000 adults in poverty through, and we help them stabilize their realities. And it's just good common sense stuff about their lives. What do they want to do with them? Here's the information bases you probably didn't get. You choose what to use. And one community took 10 individuals, 34 people with their families, and it was a $2.1 million return to their community annually.
Wow.
There's ways to do it. We're doing it.
Yeah.
But
Ruby, if people want to follow up with you, how can they do that?
Go www.ahaprocess, AHAPROCESS.com. If they want to dive in, there's all kinds of info there. There's two books on our website you might want to get. Why Don't They Just Get a Job? And it's a foundation we work with in Cincinnati, Ohio. And he's been phenomenally successful. But one of the things, he provides a lot of mental health support. And the other one is Workplace Stability. That will give you ideas about what workplaces can do to stabilize. Yeah. But
I'm going to get them.
Thank you for all you do, Sam.
Thanks. Take care, Ruby.
Well, I had a ton of takeaways from this episode. Ruby's awesome. I must say that, you know, the point on 95% of the brain being formed before the age of six, that might explain a few things on my end. But more importantly, understanding and talking about how trauma, talking about how the impacts of poverty don't just affect someone in that moment, you know, just a single person who might dip into poverty and dip out, but the impacts of generational poverty, the point that if you grow up two generations in a row with generational poverty, your IQ has a negative impact, is wild. It's something we should think about. It's something that as a community, as a society, and as business leaders, if we really are focused on creating a workforce where everybody can participate, where everybody can be, quote, engaged, then we have to get real about the discussion around the impacts of poverty on our people. Because if I own a business and I am not thinking about what happens with a worker before they clock in and after they clock out, first off, you're not the kind of brand I want my daughter working for. And most importantly, I don't think you're a brand that's going to win in the future of work tomorrow. That's the way you're operating today. Ruby said, today we have unbelievable talent in the workforce. They're just not developed and they're not challenged. With labor being such a tough and important topic right now, with some folks believing people are standing on the sidelines and some believing that it's too hard to find, and some believing some are lazy, and some believing some don't have the skills. For all of these reasons, including recent research that shows that as many as one in two workers are considering switching jobs before the end of this year, it's being deemed the Great Resignation. It's for all of these reasons that we need to go back and listen to someone like Ruby Payne and other leaders who work to create environments to pay a living wage, to give workers the educational opportunities to skill themselves up, to create opportunities for workers to level up, to create an environment where workers don't have to think about the challenge of childcare. It's for all of these reasons that the future of work discussion has to include an exploration of so many of the points that Ruby made. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for your work. I highly encourage you to go to your local bookstore or go to Ruby's website, ahaprocess.com, and pick up a copy of either Emotional Poverty or A Framework for Understanding Poverty, or both. Right, Jaime? You can buy both.
Buy both.
Now, don't forget to subscribe to Bring It In so you never miss an episode. We've got some awesome guests lined up that you're not going to want to miss. Now, back to work.